and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today we will hear part two of a conversation that I had with local naturalist Steve Grace just after he emerged from snorkeling off the beach in front of the Northwest Maritime Center in downtown Port Townsend. Part one of this interview aired about a month ago in early August. But before we do that, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Actually, I'd be a bit surprised if you have ever heard the sound of this creature. It is common in our skies, especially in the spring and the autumn. That's enough of the hint. Well, we are currently, of course, at the beginning of the fall bird migration season. Old summer friends have left. All the rufous hummingbirds near my feeder seem to have already headed south. And new friends are arriving or just passing through. I want to share some wonderful tools to help us learn more about real-time predictions and migration times and patterns. First, there's a publicly available web tool called BirdCast. It provides visual and computer-modeled maps that incorporate years of historical data, along with current weather predictions. BirdCast's migration forecast maps and local bird migration alerts are predicted for the nocturnal migrations 3 hours before the local sunset, and they are updated every 6 hours. BirdCast also provides special local bird migration alerts. And then for information on the status of local migrations of specific species, also check out eBird. Web-based eBird has a reputation as the world's largest biodiversity-related citizen science project. And you can find migration information and maps specific to individual species and locations on the eBird app. And for the in-person experience, local naturalist extraordinaire Dave Rue suggests catching glimpses of our own avian travelers from strategic viewpoints, such as headlands, beaches, lakes, or ponds. And within short distances around Port Townsend, you could try Point Wilson, the beaches on either side of Point Wilson, Point Hudson, Cotai Lagoon, North Beach, and Fort Worden, and also Fort Flagler, of course. But now let's switch ecosystems and go to the marine world. And we're going to visit some nearshore marine areas with Steve Grace. And so as I mentioned earlier, Steve is a local naturalist and he has a vast knowledge of things both terrestrial and aquatic and maritime. So let's listen to that conversation.
So Steve, we're here along this old pier and we're almost at low tide and we can see barnacles, we can see some kelp washed up, there's a few closed up aggregating sea anemones. Oh, and there's even a blood star that looks a little worse for wear. So I think many of us have probably seen these kind of intertidal barnacle beds. What happened as you swam out along into the water?
Yeah, that's what's really fun about this process, because everything we're looking at now, I could go under the water out there, under the waves, and take a look at the exact same things, and they'd look completely different. There's a radical transformation that takes place. The barnacles open up and they start feeding. They're little crustaceans inside those volcano-shaped shells, and they have what's called a cirri, a little feeding appendage. They put that out. It's almost like a little eyelash combing through the water. And sometimes on a sunny day, you can see countless thousands of these barnacles open and feeding. And you realize these are living creatures. There's crustaceans in there.
Yeah, I've certainly been enchanted by that in various aquaria, and sort of think of it as the barnacles lying on their back with their feet in the air and their toes in the air, just kind of pulling it in, and they do it sort of in symphonies with each other. So you get this kind of wave over it.
Nice.
And then I'm also amazed that they are so tough that they can close up so tight.
Yeah.
When they're exposed to water and protect all those sensitive tissues from drying out. What else along here did you see?
Yeah, what else? So we've got the aggregating anemones that you mentioned. So a lot of people are probably familiar with anemones. And of course, when they're out of the water, they look like just sort of a nondescript little lump, a little gelatinous lump. It's hard to imagine that those are animals. Not only are they animals, but they're carnivorous, predatory animals.
They're small, like quarter size or so, and they in groups.
Yeah.
And they're sort of greenish with, and if you look really close, you can see pinkish tips.
Right, yeah. And their name is, their scientific name comes from the word elegance. And they are, even though they look sort of hideous when they're out of the water, when they're underwater, it's like Beauty and the Beast. They become very elegant. They open up and they extend their stinging tentacles, which are tipped with pink. They're quite lovely. And you can see them sometimes grabbing onto creatures and eating. You can see this in tide pools too, but to be out in the water, you tend to see it more. And it's an extraordinary sight. All these things that seem relatively mundane that we might see on a pier or on some rocky habitat out of the water, as soon as you add some water to the mix, all of a sudden they really become alive and vibrant. They're transformed.
What kind of animals do they prey on?
So they'll eat pretty much anything that floats by. I mean, these guys are kind of smaller. They're eating things like little crustaceans. But anemones have been known to, they can eat fish. There's a species called the giant green anemone, which I've seen here once by the Marine Science Center.
Yeah,
they're much more common
I've
out on the coast.
I've only seen them towards the open coast.
Yeah. And they'll eat things as large as fish, crabs, like Dungeness crabs, even birds. A colleague of mine on the Oregon coast documented giant green anemones eating seabirds, believe it or not, goldchicks and young cormorants. So they are quite predatory. They'll sort of grab and eat whatever animal swims by that they can get their tentacles on. And they also do a clone war. They clone themselves. These aggregate anemones have territorial wars, believe it or not. They clone themselves, make genetic clones, and as these colonies expand, they have battles with rival colonies. And the anemones on the end become warrior clones or warrior polyps, and they have special battle armaments that they extend to do battle with their competitors in other colonies. And so I've seen this under the water, and that's pretty exciting to watch. It kind of happens in slow motion, so you have to be patient.
Well, and I've got to tell listeners, this is one of Steve's favorite stories. I've heard him talk about the battling sea anemones several times. You can hear the smile on his face when he's talking about the sea anemone wars.
Well, we've got this this bull kelp here too.
Yeah,
which is
let's
out of the
talk
water.
About so, the macroalgae.
Yeah,
see.
So not kind of like the anemones, not so pretty when it's out of the water. It's kind of desiccated, not at its best. But you add a little water to the mix. If we get out there and see some living macroalgae, some of this bull kelp out there that's anchored with its holdfast to the bottom and alive, those blades, so they kind of look like leaves, basically function like leaves on a plant that are photosynthesizing. And out in the water, they spread out, they fan out on the water. And on a sunny day, it creates the most extraordinary visual effect because you can swim through these forests of macroalgae, especially the bull kelp, and those blades or fronds sort of shatter the light, and it's almost like a stained glass cathedral effect. It's one of the most beautiful things I've seen anywhere on the planet, and it's just right here, just right offshore.
So how deep?
You have to go a little bit deeper to get into the macroalgae forests. So the trick with that is to go low tide. We're at a pretty low tide right now. If you go out at the lowest minus tides, you can get into the macroalgae forests without going too deep in the water. Again, if people are a little tentative about getting in the water, if they're not, real confident in their swimming skills or worried about currents, if you go at a really low minus tide, you can easily float over the top of these macroalgae forests.
And the currents, of course, are going to be much less at those minus tide
nice
when it's ready to turn.
So there are ways to safely and efficiently do that. And I would just encourage everyone to do it because it's, to me, it's just as interesting as a tropical rainforest. And it's right here. It's this wonderland beneath the waves. And it's more accessible than a lot of people would imagine.
So what kind of creatures would you see in that kelp forest?
Yeah, so when I was just out there earlier, I saw kelp crabs, which I love.
Oh, those are
because
so cool.
We tend to think of, we tend to think of crabs, like decapod crabs that sort of scuttle sideways. And that happens with our Dungeness crabs and our red rock crabs, which I saw at the base of those macroalgae, of the bull kelp. But what I saw climbing up the macroalgae were the kelp crabs. And they have these little kind of like spider-like appendages and little hooks at the end of their legs, and they just climb like little superheroes. It's amazing.
So let's describe a kelp crab. I just love that long, pointy rostrum nose thing. So for a radio listener, describe a kelp crab.
Oh, yeah. So their carapace, and that's their shell. So most people kind of have an image of a Dungeness crab. So let's kind of imagine that, conjure up a Dungeness crab carapace. But like you said, they have that wonderful rostrum that's extended. And their carapace is sort of shaped like a shield. They have really long spidery legs. At the ends of those legs are little hooks. And with those hooks, they use those for climbing. And they have incredible climbing prowess. They climb these towering bull kelp, which can be, you know, 20, 30, mm-hmm. 40, 50, even 60 feet tall. So this would be like us climbing a skyscraper, right?
Yeah.
And that's how they evade their predators. And then they feed on the kelp as they climb. So it's a really different experience of interacting with a crab, much different than like a Dungeness crab, mm-hmm. or a red rock crab, or a shore crab scuttling across the shore.
And you actually saw those when you were just out there recently.
I did, yeah. I was out there for about 10 minutes, so I saw several northern kelp crab. I also saw a hairy helmet crab. And
really?
They're similar to, they have a little bit of a look like a northern kelp crab, but they have this this carapace that looks hairy.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not hair. They're sort of these little projections that look hair-like. It almost looks like it's nice and soft if you went to touch it.
But it's not,
an extraordinary yellow cut. Not so soft. And an extraordinary yellow color. Some of them are absolutely vibrant yellow, like almost something you'd see in the tropics. The first time I saw one, I was just shocked. I thought, did this wander here from...
somewhere else?
Yeah, float up here from the equator. But yeah, they're beautiful and they're out there. And some of the fish, too, the coloring is just incredible. I didn't realize that fish so beautiful could live in cold waters until I moved here. I always thought of really colorful fish as living on coral reefs. Mm-hmm. But I'll put a... you know, like a greenling, say like a rock greenling or a kelp greenling. I'd put a rockfish, like a China rockfish or a canary rockfish or even a striped surf perch. I mean, to me, these are just as beautiful, just as striking, just as colorful as anything you'd see in a tropical coral reef.
So let's talk about color for just a minute. I remember the first time I ever went scuba diving in the Pacific Ocean, the thing that struck me was all the intense color and the variety of color. What range of colors did you see out there?
So there were a couple blood stars, so that adds some nice reds. There were some beautiful anemones. There's one called a painted anemone, or some people call it a Christmas anemone.
Yeah, the red and green.
Yeah, it has some red and green. And again, like when those are closed, maybe not so charismatic. When they're open, they're gorgeous. They're stunning. What I just saw that I really like are the plumose anemones. And so the color there is sort of a ghostly pale, almost a translucent white.
Right.
Very ethereal, very phantom-like. And you can find forests of these along the piers.
And they can be really big.
They can be really big. The world's tallest anemone, right? One of many superlatives in the Salish Sea. They can get up to 3 feet tall. And you can swim through forests of these, and it's like being in a Dr. Seuss land. It's absolutely surreal. So those are quite gorgeous. But yeah, the color palette, I think, is every bit as varied and as intense as a tropical coral reef. We have pink coralline algae here.
Oh, yes.
Which is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, and that can come in different forms. It can be encrusting. It can also have a tree-like form or a bushy form. And that's some beautiful, vibrant pink. And yeah, a lot of our fish are pretty amazing. We have the buffalo sculpins, a fish that I've really enjoyed seeing lately. And they camouflage themselves to match macroalgae forests. So they're trying to match the green algaes and the browns and the reds and the all these different colors. Mm-hmm. So they have a color palette that's sort of maroon and yellow and green and brown, all mixed together and modeled. They look absolutely improbable when you put them on a monotonous surface. But when they're mixed in one of those macroalgae forests, they disappear brilliantly. They're absolutely beautiful, and they rely on their camouflage, so you can swim right up to them, and they just stay in place. And I've seen some that, it's just hard to believe. You almost think like an artist is out there painting them. It's hard to believe nature came up with that.
So can they change their camouflage coloring with the background they're on?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. That species specifically, I'm not sure. I know that's definitely been demonstrated with other sculpin species. I believe that one can do it, too. They can change their color to match the background. It's kind of a slower process. You know, it's not like an octopus instantaneously changing its color. But they will change their color to adapt to different colored backgrounds.
So how about blues? Do you see blues out there?
Oh, wow, this is a cool theme. I like the color theme. blues. Okay, so blues. Okay, and so this goes back to this idea that things that are relatively mundane that we see all the time on the shore you might not think are beautiful. You see them under the water, and they are striking. And so that would be the blue mussel, which we have a few mixed in here.
Yeah.
And I've seen those in the past and haven't paid much attention mm-hmm. to them. But when I saw some underwater in Discovery Bay a few weeks ago, they were open. You know, they open their shells mm-hmm. when they're underwater. They're filter feeding. Mm-hmm. They're pulling material out of the water to feed and to breathe. And when they open up, you can see this rim of sort of bluish flesh inside the black shell. Bluish flesh, and the color was absolutely extraordinary. It was a sunny day, the sun was striking it, reflecting and shimmering off this blue, and I thought, I've seen that color before. Where have I seen that blue? It's so vibrant, so improbable. And finally it hit me. It was later that day when I was out of the water, and I said, I know what it is. It's the blue morpho butterfly that I saw in the jungles of Brazil several years ago. It's the exact same color. And there it was in the Salish Sea, in this soupy green sea, where a lot of people assume there isn't color, there isn't variety, there isn't diversity. It was as striking as a butterfly in a tropical forest.
Wow. So let's see. Oh, color. Let's talk about algae again. We talked about the bull kelp, which is a brown algae.
Mm-hmm.
They're brown, greens, and red algaes. What do you see out there?
The one I've really enjoyed lately is called sugar kelp. So that's another brown algae. That's mm-hmm. one of the kelps. And the blades are unbelievably long. I just can't believe how long some of them are. In the literature, I've read that they get at least 6 feet long, but I've seen ones that seem much, much longer.
Hmm.
My wingspan's about 6 feet, you know, when I stretch my arms out. And I've found some that are, it seems to me like they're twice my wingspan, like maybe going 10 to 12 feet. And they undulate, they sort of, you know, move slowly in the currents. And swimming through those is a very strange and compelling experience.
So describe the blade itself.
Yeah, so the blade itself is relatively flat, but it does have some puckering. So there are a few lines of sort of a puckered appearance where it's, you know, almost like the, you imagine it's sort of like flat material, but a little of it's been sort of mm-hmm. gathered up and made a few lines of puckering along the blade. But the blades can be quite wide, you know, maybe 6 inches or so wide or maybe even more, maybe
and
8 inches.
And they're anchored to rocks?
Yeah, so they have what's called a hold fast. They don't have a root system because they're not a plant. They're an algae, and that hold fast grabs onto the rocks and holds them there. Most seaweeds or macroalgae have, you know, they can either have a discoid hold fast that's mm-hmm. shaped like a little suction cup disc, which
yeah.
is kind of fun to see, or they can have projections that look almost root-like that
yeah,
sort of grasp
gnarly
the rocks.
Ones
yeah, those cool, like kind of gnarly. And then if you look
yeah.
really closely into those gnarled root-like hold fasts, a lot of times those are little microcosms. They're entire worlds holding all sorts of creatures. There's little marine worms that live
mm-hmm.
in there and tiny crabs that hide in there and little starfish. Yeah.
So green algae.
Well, I think the most vibrant green that I see out there, the one I really like, and this is one a lot of people are familiar with that's just, you know, right here on the shore is this sea lettuce.
Yeah.
And so when it's out of the water, it gets kind of, you know, it just looks like kind of old, like desiccated cellophane or something.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get in some that's under the water, that's, you know, it's been under the water for a little while, it's revived, it's moving around. And on a sunny day, it's photosynthesizing, so it's covered in silvery bubbles of oxygen that
and
it's releasing.
To me, it's one of the most
really beautiful.
Perfect greens.
Yeah,
it's just
I like that. Yeah, it's a
vibrant,
perfect green.
Perfect green.
Yeah, in Plato's cave of ideal forms, it's like that is green. Yeah,
that's green.
The quintessential green. Yeah, that's
okay,
cool.
And then the reds.
Reds, oh, let's see. So there's a red fan algae that I love, and that it has a beautiful, it's almost like tendrils or lace. I love to sort of run my fingers through it, but that's a beautiful, vibrant red. And of course, there's the sea noodles, right? Or some people
mm-hmm.
call it red spaghetti,
mm-hmm.
which sometimes you see on shore, but again, it's a lot more interesting when it's out there, sort of in the mix in one of those macroalgae forests.
Interesting. You know, Steve, you've just almost got me convinced. I've sort of consider myself in the very much in the fair weather snorkel group. Warm water, but I'm almost ready to go snorkeling here.
Oh, what would it take to convince you?
I'm
man?
Not sure.
Yeah,
you're doing a good job.
Okay, check this out. Here's something that motivates me on days when I'm thinking, oh, do I want to do this? Because there is that initial shock when you get in.
Yeah,
and
of course.
And you just
yeah.
think, what am I doing?
You're right.
I could have been doing anything else. Why am I in cold water? But what I do is I go out on sunny days, and I have spots that I know where the rocks really hot, really heat up in the sun.
Oh, so you get
that are like west facing and late in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I know the rocks are just going to be baking. I mean, almost hot to the touch. So I get in the water, and if I start getting a little chilly, I start thinking about that, and I think, man, I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to be chilly, I'm going to be shivering a little bit, but I'm going to lay down on those hot rocks
mm-hmm.
in this late afternoon sun and warm up. It's almost like having that image of a cabin and hot chocolate when you're out skiing. It's like sometimes that gets me through, it gets me motivated.
Well, that's quite the motivation. Well, Steve, this has been great fun. And as I say, you've almost got me convinced to do it. And I hope you've got a bunch of listeners all excited. No special equipment needed. Wetsuit might be nice. I do have a wetsuit that I've had for swimming in tropical waters, but I am sure it would do here too. Actually, I need to ask you, is that a heavy-duty wetsuit or is...
Yeah, I don't, you know, this was actually a hand-me-down. Somebody gave this to me, and it doesn't fit as well as it should. You know, if I were really motivated, I'd probably get a one that fits a little bit better. But yeah, I think it may be a 7 millimeter. I mean,
okay,
it's pretty,
so
pretty
that
thick.
Is pretty thick.
And pretty
yeah.
buoyant. I mean, I float like a cork. I couldn't sink if I wanted to. I'd have to put 35 pounds of weight on. So
do you, actually, that's sort of another kind of special equipment question. To get down to swim in the water, do you wear a weight belt?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I do, but usually I just... when I'm wearing the wetsuit, I don't worry about the weight belt, part because a lot of places I go, I hike or I run, and I don't want 35 pounds of lead on my back. But sometimes when I'm not wearing the wetsuit, you know, then I can dive down.
And the weight's
But the truth is, you could spend, you know, days out here, months, years doing this and see new and extraordinary things every time. There's absolutely no need to go under the surface. I mean, if you want to, if people feel adventurous, that's great. If they want to take it to the next level and scuba dive, that's great. But I just want people to know that this is accessible, it's safe if done, you know, with some thought and some common sense. And I don't want this show in any way to substitute for people having their own experiences. I simply want this to serve as an invitation for other people to join me out here in this wonderland beneath the waves and for them to come up with their own stories, have their own experiences, get kids out here, seniors. I mean, this is accessible and available for everyone.
Well, Steve, this has been a wonderful conversation down here by the water, and you've inspired me, and I hope you've inspired others. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Nan.
Well, that was fun. Oh, I also need to add, I heard from Steve recently that he went hiking up in the alpine areas of the Olympic Peninsula. And in addition to backpacking supplies and his ice axe, he also took his snorkeling gear. And he snorkeled in those alpine lakes watching trout and salamanders. I think he's becoming kind of an aquatic guy. Well, let's hear that mystery sound again. Well, I will actually plainly admit that I have never heard that sound in the wild. But since I really wanted to talk about turkey vultures this week, I searched the web to find this recording of the low, guttural hisses that turkey vultures make when they are irritated or when they're vying for a better spot on the carcass. Turkey vultures actually completely lack the vocal organs that would be needed to make proper bird songs or calls. I don't need to say too much about turkey vultures. Most of us probably recognize them as the large, dark birds with long, broad wings soaring in the skies. Bigger than other raptors, except eagles and condors, turkey vultures have long, sort of fingers at the ends of their wingtips. And when soaring, turkey vultures hold their wings slightly raised, making a V when seen head on. And they feed on carrion and have a wonderfully adapted red head, naked of feathers. I can think like all the better to eat you with, my dear. What I want to mention today is their kettling behavior. When a group of birds, especially vultures and raptors such as hawks, ride the thermal updrafts together in a wheeling and circling pattern, that is known as kettling, or a kettle of birds. Think of the slow stirring of a huge cauldron or soup pot in the sky, and you'll get the idea. This is the time of year that groups of turkey vultures, often up to several hundred birds, gather and kettle on Vancouver Island as they get ready to head across the Strait of Juan de Fuca to the Olympic Peninsula. One of their favorite landfalls on our side of the strait is near Salt Creek County Park, just west of Port Angeles. Expect their numbers there to peak in probably late September, and already even in early September, small numbers of vultures have made their crossing. both Dave Rue and Wendy Feltham have spotted small groups of vultures near Quilcene Bay. Since turkey vultures soar and glide extensively on thermals and mountain updrafts while migrating, we see concentrations along mountain ridges, shorelines, and coastlines. And because they rely on those thermals and updrafts to provide them with the sources of lift, these vultures typically avoid crossing large bodies of water that would require them to engage in long bouts of powered flight. This is one of the reasons why the crossing here is quite special. And of course, they do not migrate on rainy or completely overcast days because the thermals don't form then. Well, do look for Ketling. And that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesday, right after the Community Resources and Calendar, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5 p.m. after the local news, and on Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. The ending music is That's What Friends Are For, or otherwise known as the Vulture Song. It's a song from the Walt Disney film The Jungle Book from 1967, and it was sung by a quartet of mop-top vultures who are making friends with Mowgli, the main character of the film. Find a YouTube video to get the full effect of those mop-top vultures singing.
We are friends, we are friends, we are friends to the bitter end. When you're alone, when you're alone, who comes around, who comes around to pluck you up,
to pluck you up
when friends are for, and when you are lost, the entire Disney was at your side, at lightning speed. We're friends with every creature coming down the pike. In fact, we never met an animal we didn't like. So you can see, we're friends
in need.
We're friends in need and friends in
friends,
need.
Friends in need.
Oh, friends in need.
We are friends in need.
We'll keep you safe in the jungle.
For